on ABC Radio New South Wales. This is the Country Hour.
And it's Michael Condon here with you on the program today. Cotton farmers are looking at ways of tackling the huge spray drift that we saw causing millions of dollars of damage earlier this year. It appears that some chemical users just aren't using best practice.
SOS Macquarie Valley is a group representing all aspects of agricultural industry that was formed last summer in response to a lot of spray drift damage. And we encompass farmers, cotton farmers, grain farmers, resellers, chemical sellers, agronomists and chemical producers, chemical manufacturers.
We'll hear more about that pilot program coming up shortly on the program, but you might have some views about spray drift. Has it affected you? It affected quite a number of farmers this year. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. But let's look at other chemical issues today. First up, and one of the world's biggest agrochemical companies is facing a headline legal challenge over its top-selling weed killer, glyphosate, commonly known as Roundup. The challenge has been mounted by a Californian man dying of cancer, and the company he's targeting is Monsanto. Jess Davis spoke to the lawyer, Pedro Esfandari, who's representing the plaintiff, Dwayne Johnson.
There's actually several hundreds, if not thousands at this point, cases pending against Monsanto in courts across the United States. And all those cases are alleging injuries related to exposure to Monsanto's flagship product, Roundup, which is a herbicide that's used across the world. Used heavily in the United States, and we represent several hundreds of plaintiffs who have developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a form of cancer as a result of using or being exposed to Monsanto's Roundup. The current case of in trial is being brought by a plaintiff we represent, Mr. Lee Johnson, and Mr. Johnson used Monsanto's product Roundup as part of his job as a school groundskeeper here in the Bay Area in California, and he developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We filed the suit, and now we are in the midst of trial against Monsanto on behalf of Mr. Johnson.
Monsanto would argue that there's been lots of scientific proof that these aren't effects from glyphosate or Roundup. So what evidence are you presenting to the contrary?
Sure. So we have several well-conducted epidemiological studies that assess the effects of Roundup in people who are actually using it in the real world. And these epi studies go back, you know, all the way back to the 80s. There's about seven or eight primary ones that we're relying upon, as well as a huge database of toxicological data, which is primarily lab studies of glyphosate effects on mice and rats, as well as what are called mechanistic studies. Those are studies that are looking at glyphosate or Roundup's effects on the cellular level, on both the animal species as well as human studies. And the entire database, the totality of that database, pretty confidently establishes that Roundup is a human carcinogen.
And what's happening with the case? What kind of case is it, and what do you hope to get out of it?
Sure. So this is a personal injury case. Mr. Johnson has obviously suffered physical injuries as a result of his exposure to Roundup. He has also suffered, you know, tremendous emotional distress. Both him and his family have. So the lawsuit is seeking compensation from Monsanto on behalf of Mr. Johnson for the injuries that he has sustained. Now, there is an additional element to this lawsuit. We're not only seeking compensation for the injuries sustained by Mr. Johnson, but we're also seeking damages that are directed at dissuading Monsanto from ever repeating such conduct in the future. It's called punitive damages. And they're less concerned with what happened to Mr. Johnson directly and more concerned with Monsanto's conduct in general. So that's an additional element of this case.
How long are you expecting the hearings to go for, and when might we expect an outcome?
Sure. So currently we're in the middle of presenting the evidence to the jury here in San Francisco. And we're expecting that process to go all the way through to July into early August. It's difficult to put an exact dead kind of stop on when the trial will end and a verdict will be rendered. However, we are looking at early to mid-August at the moment.
And as you mentioned, there's sort of a bigger consequences if you do win this court case. Is it likely that the other hundreds of cases against Monsanto will be affected by the outcome of this?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that whatever happens in Mr. Johnson's case is going to have some kind of an impact on the other cases. But we are more than, you know, ready and able to ensure that Monsanto, or rather our plaintiffs, have the day in court and that Monsanto is judged accordingly with respect to each plaintiff before a jury of its peers. And now, you know, the result of this case is obviously going to have impact going down the road. And you know, if we prevail in this case, obviously, you know, Monsanto is going to be in trouble, quite frankly. But, if, you know, each case will be decided on its own merits, ultimately.
That's lawyer Pedro Esfandiary, and he was speaking there to Jess Davis about that court case against Monsanto. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 12 minutes past 12. We're still looking at chemicals, and it'd be nice to assume that there's a strong sense of fraternity amongst farmers, that they go to pains to ensure they don't have a negative impact on each other's crops. But huge amounts of spray drift damage earlier this year has underlined a problem that many producers say has been bubbling away under the surface for years, and that is that some chemical users just aren't using best practice. Sally Bryant has this report.
Cotton growers in valleys right across the eastern states took a big hit this year from spray drift, with millions of dollars in lost income. It's an issue that farmers say has been bubbling along under the surface for years, but every time there is a spike in the problem, there is talk about doing something about it. Now a group in the New South Wales Central West, in the Macquarie Valley, has gone on the front foot to find a solution. Farmer Tony McCallery is the chairman.
SOS Macquarie Valley is a group representing all aspects of agricultural industry that was formed last summer in response to a lot of spray drift damage. And we encompass farmers, cotton farmers, grain farmers, resellers, chemical sellers, agronomists and chemical producers, chemical manufacturers. And I suppose we, more importantly, partnered with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority.
What sorts of initiatives have you come up with today?
So we are planning immediately, well, mainly the EPA is, to have a meeting of experts, people who deliver scientific programs on spray drift, have a meeting in Sydney with them to make sure that we're all using the same technology and understanding the same message that has to be delivered. We're also doing a survey which is to benchmark the attitude and practices of growers so that it can be measured in a year or 2 years' time to see what sort of progress we're making. We're planning a workshop for agronomists who we see as the technical people in the farming system who should be able to deliver better technology to farmers, and we want to upskill them and make them again agree to a set of principles that they can deliver to their clients. And that will be followed by a big field day at the Trangie Ag Research Station. Both those programs are at Trangie Ag Station. We're hopeful that that will give us a good start to the next summer season before the crops go in, for cotton particularly. But this is really not just about cotton, because we see damage in other crops. And we believe that with the advent of dicamba-resistant cotton varieties that we will see, if we don't improve our practice, we'll see a lot of damage in grape crops and nut crops down on the Murrumbidgee and Murray areas, and a lot of pressure to ban certain chemicals, which is going to be detrimental to the agricultural industry.
When you're dealing with issues like this, people say a two-pronged approach is necessary, carrot and stick. How much carrot, how much stick?
Well, the EPA has, at this stage in our program, adopted the carrot approach because they feel that they can get more advantage from that. One of the EPA officers was here today advancing another theory that they think that there are people that will never respond to the carrot and that you have to take the stick out. But we haven't put that in our program, but obviously that is the other possibility.
This group represents all facets of agriculture in the region, and Chief Executive Officer of the Yarana Grain Alliance, Maurie Street, says it's essential that everyone's at the table, not just cotton growers.
Cotton's just a really effective canary in the coal mine. It's just a really good litmus paper that's detecting this off-target drift. So it's just as much affecting other crops, parks, gardens, the environment as a whole. So why is it coming up? I think it's just an issue that's been bubbling along, and it's just slowly getting warmer and warmer, and it's just starting to spill over the top. And I think I think it's got to the stage now where we feel as an industry and the SOS committee as a group have felt that we needed to try and tackle the problem.
Because there is an element in here, isn't there? You've got a social licence to use these chemicals at the moment. Are you a bit concerned that if people don't toe the line, that you'll lose some of these chemicals?
I think that's always a risk, and it's something that we want to avoid. I think if you think about it, it's not hard to imagine that if we don't fix this as an industry and fix it on our terms, I think, there's a very good chance that someone will fix it for us. So I think there's certainly a need there for us to have a look at it and do the best job we can and minimise that risk.
Dubbo-based agronomist Matt Shepherd says it's both a professional and personal issue for him.
I've actually had a cotton crop severely affected this year by spray drift, as well as being a worker in the industry as an agronomist. I'm a farmer as well, and I'm certainly looking at it from both sides of the coin.
What, from your perspective, looking at both sides of the fence, what needs to happen?
I think we've got a lot of engagement from the main industry stakeholders, like the EPA, APVMA, a lot of the chemical companies. From my perspective, I think getting more growers, we see a lot of growers who are getting educated and changing their practices. We need to see more of the growers who aren't getting educated and learning some of the new practices, getting along to some of the training days, or even just getting involved, asking more questions about whether or not they think they're doing the right thing, asking their neighbours who may be showing some leadership in the industry in how they're conducting their spraying. Just start talking to them. If they're not sure, in this game with spray drift, knowledge is everything. You need to understand the conditions that you're spraying in. You need to understand what equipment you're using and that matches the conditions.
What level of accreditation is there for spray operators?
Look, at the moment, it's really a ChemCert accreditation.
Does there need to be something a little bit more rigorous?
Look, I think further education will always help. Whether that will solve the problem, there is a question mark, because I think the majority of the problems are being caused by those who aren't willing participants in that sort of industry. And yes, they'll obtain their basic ChemCert accreditation, but that may not be giving them the full industry knowledge that they need for using their boom spray or their application methods.
And the ABC has approached the EPA for comment on how they plan to work with farmers in this program. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. A few texts on that issue already. Mick texted in to say maybe the cotton farmers should pay for the spraying of the fields near their cotton when it is susceptible to damage, although when the weather conditions are right, the spray can uplift into the air, Mick, and be travelled can travel about 1 or 2 kilometres. So that may not be practical. Alan's texted in saying, looking in from the sideline, does the spray drift issue come in the same category as the organophosphate poisoning issue that we saw a couple of decades ago? Just a thought there from Alan. It's 20 minutes past 12.
It's time to unearth the best farmers in the country, with nominations now open for the 2018 Australian Farmer of the Year Awards. Celebrating innovation, diversity and success, we're looking for the industry's best. Enter yourself or someone you know for title of Farmer of the Year, Young Farmer of the Year or Farming Legend of the Year. Find the details at farmeroftheyear.com.au. The Australian Farmer of the Year Awards, proudly supported by Condinan Group and ABC Rural.
So get your entries in. And a national project aimed at reducing farmer suicide has found negative attitudes to poor mental health still remain in rural communities. The Ripple Effect has been designed by the National Centre for Farmer Health and provides people with an opportunity to tell their stories through an online survey. Jess Davis spoke to lead researcher Dr. Alison Kennedy, who says the surveys have found farmers still find it difficult to reach out for help.
We've discovered that we have a nice wide variety of people from around Australia, so it's a nicely representative sample of people in the farming community from around Australia. While the intervention was designed for males aged 30 to 64, we've actually found that there's a large proportion of females who have participated in the Ripple Effect. And anecdotally, I guess, we believe that this may be because females want to come to the website and have a look at it in order to then be able to convince the males in their life to participate. And we also believe that females are strongly affected by suicide in rural areas as well, so find that this is appropriate for their needs too.
And one of the key findings in your study is about how stigma can affect suicide. Can you take me through what it is about stigma and why that is?
So stigma is a real problem. It's associated with some of the cultural things that we see in rural areas. So we find that people are great at supporting others, but they're not so great at asking for help. And there is a negative association between having poor mental health or struggling emotionally with not coping and somehow being a lesser person. So really that's what some of the reasoning behind developing the Ripple Effect was.
What did the participants say about stigma themselves that you might be looking into for future research or that really stood out to you?
Sure. One of the interesting things that we saw, we measured suicide literacy in people who participated in the Ripple Effect program. And when we compare this to levels of literacy in the general Australian population, the people that participated in the Ripple Effect have a much higher knowledge about suicide and its effects and its risk factors. So that was particularly interesting for us to see that. And in some ways it's not so surprising, given that the people who come to the Ripple Effect generally have some experience of suicide in their lives. So I guess we expect in that case that they're more likely to know about suicide and its risk factors and what contributes to loss of life.
In that case, if the participants coming to you already have that higher literacy, how do you think a program like yours or reducing stigma can happen on a wider community level for those people who aren't engaging in conversations like this?
I think one thing that we've seen from the Ripple Effect Project is very much the idea of it being having a ripple effect. We're seeing conversations start not only from people who are participating in the Ripple Effect, but on a much, much broader level, which is very difficult to measure. But we have certainly seen lots of conversations start out there through our social media posts and our social media pages. We've had people approach us to come and talk about the ripple effect. We've had young people actually, you know, tell us about things that they're doing in their communities and in their schools to raise awareness and to reduce stigma. So I think in many ways the ripple effect has provided an opportunity for people to start to have those conversations. So I think not only will literacy in that case increase in the people that are simply participating or high levels of literacy in that group, then I think we'll also see there's potential there for increased literacy in the broader rural population.
And on a personal note, you've obviously been very involved in this project and heard lots of stories about farmer suicide. How has it affected you, or what have you taken out of it personally, not as a researcher?
Yeah, look, my overarching feeling of working in this area is one of privilege. You know, to have people trust you enough to want to share their stories and know that they will be handled very sensitively and used for the benefit of others, it's just really incredible being a part of a program like this. You meet in amazing people who have experienced incredible things in their lives and have grown and gone on to do, you know, wonderful things in their community. And so it really is a great privilege to work in this area.
Lead researcher for the Ripple Effect, Dr. Alison Kennedy. If you're having any issues with mental health or know of anybody that is at the moment, you can call Lifeline 131114. That's 131114 or Beyond Blue 1300 224 636, or you can look up the details on their websites. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. It's 26 minutes past 12. More response to the spray drift story. Dave in Moree's texted in to say Tokau College does a spray drift course. The more knowledge, the better. And someone's talking about a point of sale requirement similar to what's required for the use and application of 1080 poison. You could implement that use and then you might see the spray drift damage reduced significantly, I think that is what they're saying. You can always send us a text about any of the stories you hear on the program. 0467 922 684 is a number to text us here at the Country Hour. Well, being able to take the jet ski off the back of a mega luxury yacht at lunchtime, access to other big toys on the deck of a multi-million dollar vessel, well, that's a world away from plunging your hands into compost and looking for worms. But that was the life that Peter Axisa once had. Very different to being involved with the permaculture industry and organic farming after purchasing a worm farm around 20 kilometres north of Wingham.
I love ecosystems. For me, that's kind of where I'm coming at it. So organics is just one of the things that I've kind of slowly developed an interest in. I see a lot of potential there, particularly for high-end products, which matters when you're dealing with small-scale operations. For me, organics is really just about harnessing the way nature does it and getting accredited for it, I guess.
Now, you've come to this in a fairly circuitous route. You were sailing the high seas around the Caribbean and the Bahamas on luxury yachts, and you were a bosun. How did you get there?
Well, it wasn't so glorious as that. It was more scrubbing decks on big white boats. Even though I wanted to do sailing, I ended up in luxury yachts. And I ended up there from really trying to escape my situation. I was heavily ridden with debt, and there was an opportunity for me to go and experience the world, and I kind of just jumped in with all feet, and I ended up spending 3 years traveling around the world working some of the most beautiful yachts and places in the world.
They're called yachts, but they don't have sail. They tend to be these boats that we see in the playgrounds of the rich.
Correct, yes, with the water slides off the top deck and 5 jet skis, all the toys.
Now you've ended up with a worm farm on the mid-north coast. How did you get involved in something so different?
Well, first of all, I guess for me, I was getting to the point in my life where I wanted to start a family, and life on the open seas is not really a place for that. I've always had a huge fascination with nature. So for me, I just wanted to build my life around living ecosystems. And sailing across the oceans, it was always one thing that I pondered into the depths of the sea, completely desolate at some points on top of it. And I always longed for that connection with land again. And I fell into the worm thing. I really did.
You bought a worm farm which had an established market with one of the major chain stores. How much have you had to learn about worms? Because at sea, probably the only time you ever thought about a worm was as bait off the end of a hook.
It was a very, very sharp learning curve. But when I was younger, my father actually had a couple of worm farms and he was selling worms to fishermen. And I really had nothing to do with worms again till this opportunity came up. And we were really just looking for business that me and my wife could run.
You were looking at expanding though, and here you are at a field day about organic dairy farming. It's not the dairy, but it's the organic side. What have you taken away from this?
The whole organic thing is obviously quite broad. There's a lot of dairy farmers. We're in dairy area. It works really well with my operation. I run a lot of my feed source from manure. I am swapping over and I have dealt with restaurant scraps in the past, and that's how I actually originally got into worm farming, is collecting restaurants. But there was a whole bunch of added pressure to make sure that buckets and everything were clean. So it was more the distribution or the logistics of the collection which really made me stand back. And so I just really see organic as this wonderful opportunity.
Now, normally on a day like today, you'd be plunging your hand deep into compost created by your worms. It's drizzling. Do you ever miss being out on the high seas on this outrageously luxurious yacht?
Taking the jet skis out for a spin during our lunchtime is pretty cool. I do think about it, but my family is where it's at now.
Michael Kavanagh sounding a little bit envious there about on the high seas. He was talking to worm farmer Peter Axisa. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. It's time to get some news headlines now from Helen Zaremas. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. The ACCC says the average household could save hundreds of dollars a year on power bills if competition in the electricity sector is boosted. In a scathing report, it says policy mistakes and a lack of competition have led to higher electricity bills. Westpac's consumer sentiment index has hit its highest level in more than 4 years. That suggests Australians are feeling more confident about the outlook for the economy and their own finances. The 12 boys and their soccer coach rescued from a cave in Thailand are expected to spend the next week under observation in hospital. Meanwhile, there's been heavy rain in the area, which started not long after the rescue was finished. And the US government says it won't meet a court-mandated deadline to reunite more than 100 immigrant children with their families. The children are all under five and were separated at the Mexican border under a policy brought in by the Trump administration. More news at one, Michael.
And you were just talking about the soccer earlier.
Oh, how good was that game? How good was that game?
I didn't see it. I saw the highlights.
Oh, the skill. It just blew my mind. It was so good.
I was surprised that France was so good because I've been thinking that Belgium would win the whole thing.
Oh, but Belgium fought so hard.
And they had so many shots on goal as well.
Oh, and the actual goal. It was a header. It was magnificent.
Yeah, that was pretty
what
special.
What about Ronaldo?
And the, what, $300
million
transfer fee? $300 million, gazillion dollars. And he's reaching the end of his life as a star.
That's right. He's in his early 30s. How old?
Mm. How old is that?
My goodness.
That's nearly your age.
That's almost. Almost.
Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you later.
You going to watch it tonight?
Yes, England and Croatia. Should be interesting. I think a lot of Australians are going for England now. Oh, look, I think if they get past Croatia, yeah. I mean,
who knows?
But, I mean, I think they should win this match against Croatia. I think they've got enough firepower up front. But I've been wrong before. I was wrong about Belgium.
Well, yes, which didn't surprise me, but anyway.
And then, of course, State of Origin coming up as well.
So. Oh, yes. Oh, it's going to be a huge night. Huge night. Okay. Lots of bleary eyes tomorrow.
That's right, indeed. Thanks for that, Helen.
Goodbye.
Helen Zaremas there, who's going to catch up on some sleep in between bulletins. You're listening to The Country Hour and Rob Taggart's at the Bureau. Good afternoon, Rob.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So, soccer crazy, are you as well, or you're just going crunching the numbers trying to work out when it's next going to rain?
I tell you what, listening to that little conversation back there, I kind of think that Helen should join the soccer commentary or something for the ABC. It was marvellous.
She knows a little bit about it.
Yeah.
Yes. So any rain on the way is the question, I suppose.
Listen, there's some isolated showers coming over the southern districts over the next 24 hours or so. That's associated with a front which is moving through Victoria at the moment. But it's going to be very hit and miss. So if you're hanging out for rain, don't hold out your hopes for it. And if there are any showers, we're talking in the order of 1 or 2 millimetres, generally speaking. So tonight, affecting the southwest of the state, most likely around the Balranald and Deniliquin district. Again, don't expect too much, though. And tomorrow afternoon, the focus is on the southern ranges and the south coast. And then we don't really see anything significant at all over New South Wales until the next front comes through on Tuesday. Now, that's a long way away, and at this stage it looks like it's only mainly affecting the southwest slopes and the Alps area and maybe a few parts of the Riverina.
Do we know why... Someone texted me this, so this is why I'm asking you. Do we know why we're seeing these sort of blocking highs that are sort of sitting there that come in and stay for so long?
Yeah, well, this is a very good question. In fact, I was talking to someone about it this morning. Certainly, I can't say that climate change has anything to do with the particular pattern we're seeing at the moment. But what is consistent with climate change is that the high-pressure belt, which usually lies over northern New South Wales or southern Queensland this time of year, in most scenarios, that belt shifts further south, which prevents the fronts from coming in as regularly or as often. And that's the kind of scenario we're seeing at the moment, where the highs for the most part are sitting kind of over New South Wales or even Victoria in some instances. And July, that's not really typical of what we've seen, say, 100 years ago or so. Now, whether what we're seeing today is because of climate change, I don't think you can attribute it to that, but it's consistent with the idea, and the idea that there's a thing called the Hadley cell, which... dictates where you've got rising air rising from the tropics and it subsides, causing high pressure systems in the subtropics. That cell looks to be expanding with climate change, which means that high pressure belt shifts further southwards. And all the projections show that in a warmer climate, it will most likely reduce rainfall over the agricultural districts of New South Wales.
And it's similar to the pattern we saw last year in this same sort of winter period or a spring-winter period as well.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, those are the climate projections. What we're seeing is consistent with that. I mean, how much you can attribute climate change to what we're actually seeing now, I'm not an expert in that, and I think that's a bit harder to say, really. Mm. But it's certainly consistent with the story that the climate projections are saying for New South Wales.
We might put that question to some climate scientists in the future. But you did very well for a question without notice there, Rob.
Well, I've been reading about this because, I mean, I grew up in the Central West, and I've seen a fair... Well, growing up, you see a fair bit of drought and floods as well. I remember the 92 Ningen floods. And, I mean, as a meteorologist, you kind of care about the land and that kind of thing. And so to have a better background in this kind of thing, I thought was important to read on this. One final thing I'll add about the weather, actually, Michael, is that there's a high-pressure system moving behind the front that's coming through over the next day or two. So that's going to bring some pretty widespread frost to New South Wales. Friday morning, Saturday morning, Sunday morning, most of the state's going to drop below 0 degrees. So widespread frost over the next coming days.
So some frost out there. Okay, Rob, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Rob Taggart at the Bureau there with lots of interesting information there. And he's been doing some research and development lately as well, and that's why I threw in that question there to him. And somebody also texted me and asked me about that earlier, so that's why that issue came up. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 21 minutes to 1. Well, $13 billion, as we know, has been set aside to rescue the Murray-Darling Basin, but what has it achieved, all that money, apart from spending big on infrastructure and buying back water? Money is also being spent on complementary projects like controlling carp and also looking after key species like the mighty Murray cod. It's Australia's largest freshwater fish, but it was fished almost to extinction last century. But restocking and habitat improvement programs have turned all that around. As part of the ABC series on the iconic river sites, Cassie Huff visits the northern basin to look at very different challenges facing river managers and a success story that's almost going too well.
As the anglers make their way up from the banks of Glenlyon Dam, there's been mixed success in finding the prized Murray cod. Brian Dare owns the Glenlyon Tourist Park, located on the Queensland-New South Wales border, about 300 kilometres southwest of Brisbane. The Glenlyon Dam Fish Restocking Group is one of the oldest stocking associations in Queensland, and for many years, Murray cod fingerlings were released in the surrounding rivers to help rejuvenate the species. But it's led to a perplexing problem.
As I got older, I started to fish with a fellow called Peter Newell. And we were fishing down here on the river one day, and 38 cod in one session between the two of us. And he said to me, do you notice anything that's wrong with the fish? And I said, no. I said, we're having a ball. Catching fish, having a ball. He said, what about the size of them? We never caught a cod over 60 centimetres. And he said to me, we've caught 38 fish each. What's happening? And Peter's passed away now. He said, I want you to do something about it. And that was the instigation of getting it done, doing a study on the cod.
So for more than 10 years, Mr. Dare has mustered a team of anglers to help tag and collect data on cod in the Glenlyon Dam and surrounding border rivers. He was part of the team that filmed the first ever vision of cod nesting sites in 2013. But he's concerned about the imbalance created by releasing Murray cod in the border rivers without considering the impact on other species.
The fish in the dams are a lot bigger than the fish in the river. We've got a heap of cod in this river, and by playing God and putting these fish in, instead of looking at putting also yellowbelly and silver perch in or getting the funding to put those in, what we've done is we've caused a monster. So what's happened with from the research that we've done to date is that we will not be putting any more cod into this river system. We've got to concentrate on silver perch and yellowbelly because we were told that we needed to get our cod populations back to pre-European visitation levels. We've done that. We've overdone it. We've caused a problem to the point where every 8 metres down this river system we have a cod waiting for something to swim past. And I'm talking about 56 kilometres of water. We were possibly still would have around about 26,000 cod sitting in there waiting. Very few yellowbelly, very few silver perch, very few catfish in this river system. And it's a beautiful river. You know, we've just got to come back to looking after it a better way than what we have been.
This project that started on the border rivers has been expanded into New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia. New South Wales Senior Fisheries Manager Inland, Cameron Westaway, says getting the water managers, scientists and anglers together and using citizen science has been a big benefit for the fish. However, in much of the discussion regarding environmental water, wetlands, red gums and water birds have been more visible, with Mr. Westaway saying fish were sometimes missing as part of the picture, despite fishing forming an important contribution to regional economies and social well-being.
We want water, environmental water that suits fish. So our scientists can advise the water managers about the best times to release. So it might be on the back of a natural flow. So the fish would naturally prefer normal natural flows. That's what they've evolved to handle. So we can help that by putting a flow down on the back of a natural flow or at the right time of year or at the right temperature. So we're still learning about all those issues. And our scientists can provide the water managers with the right sort of advice.
Well, the southern basin has several sites that have been deemed significant environmentally. In the northern basin, it's less clear-cut where the focus of environmental water flows should be. The Queensland Murray-Darling Committee works with farmers and communities to protect, enhance and restore the natural environment of the Queensland Murray-Darling Basin. I caught up with Committee Chair Jeff Penton, who oversees the projects QMDC has on the go, and he says the Northern Basin Environmental Watering Plan is not necessarily based around having a healthy wetland, but more around looking after key species, including rare and endangered fish that use water to trigger breeding events.
One of our big differences in the north is that our system is much more ephemeral. We have much bigger wetting and drying cycles compared to down south. And we have fewer what you would call off-stream wetlands. So where you've got a big wetland and you can isolate that wetland and deliver water to it like they do in a lot of the southern basin. Our environmental assets are our rivers, our in-stream channel, and delivering water to a whole range of refuges, waterholes that persist through dry times. Some of them eventually dry out in a normal wetting and drying cycle, and that's normal. The plan isn't to try to achieve a river with water in it all the time, because that's not natural. But I guess one of our overall challenges is that we don't have some of those larger, separate, distinct wetlands that we're delivering water to, or that which has been the predominant thinking in the sort of southern basin in Victoria. Ours is more about how do we manage the water in the river to achieve, in-stream environmental outcomes.
The Glen Lyon Dam project has been going for about 10 years, and in that time a lot has been learned about the Murray Cod. But as the environmental watering plans have only been around for a couple of years, Jeff Penton says it's too soon to know how much impact those plans are having on fish species.
I guess Queensland Murray-Darling Committee's view from day one of the basin plan has been that there is more to river health than just water. It's very important, but we have carp, we have barriers to fish migration in weirs that very few of them have fishways. We have water weeds, we have uncontrolled stock access for hundreds if not thousands of kilometres of our creeks and streams. We've got all sorts of things, including cold water pollution from places like Glen Lyon Dam. We have a range of impacts that are happening on our rivers. So we would be keen, and have been keen, in the Northern Basin review process to see some investment in activities that would improve river health that don't necessarily involve buying more water.
Queensland Murray-Darling Committee Chair Jeff Penton speaking to Cassie Huff. And you can go online and search for the Murray-Darling Basin Iconic Sites to find out more about the effectiveness of that environmental water. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 14 minutes to one. Another text has come in on the spray drift. Graham at Wagga says he's been driving around at night and he smells crop spraying, even though it's a very still night. So he went for a bit of a drive to investigate and found there was spraying some several kilometres away. He says it's amazing how far it can travel in those, even in those sorts of conditions that I don't think he thought were particularly favourable for moving that chemical around. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 13 minutes to one. Well, let's turn our attention to the fact we've had a little bit of rain in some parts, but it may have been tempting, but farmers are being warned not to rush their livestock back into some of those green pastures where they might have seen a little bit of recent rainfall. With signs of green pick being visible in some parts of the state, vets and livestock officers are beginning to receive some calls with questions around feed and concerns over livestock which have been moved back into those paddocks. Central Tablelands LLS livestock officer Brett Littler says how to manage animals back onto green pick after such a prolonged period of dry is something farmers need to be aware of.
If you're in the scenario where you're lucky enough where you've got a paddock, you've got them locked up and you've been feeding them and you're looking at introducing, don't forget the basic rules. First and foremost, don't introduce them first thing in the morning. Try to introduce them later on in the day after they're filled up. Don't put hungry stock onto some of these green paddocks. I know it's a bit hard, but if you've got some hay, now's the time to be using some of that to fill the animals up and introduce them onto the feed. Also, make sure that there's actually enough green feed for them to meet their requirements, because what we tend to find now with that real short green pick, although quality is reasonable, there's a high moisture content, it's not very high and available, so the animals tend to eat like mad and not meet their needs. So really vital that people look at getting a bit more height in some of those paddocks. Also, really important that people are aware of what the actual paddock is. We've just started to have a couple of issues with producers with old Phalaris stands, and there's been a couple of reports of Phalaris staggers. So Sometimes you're actually better off holding them off a bit longer before you introduce it once it's got a little bit more height.
Have you heard of any problems yet?
Yeah, look, that's talking to a bloke this morning, that was his problem. He put animals out, they'd started chasing the green pick, they were stopped eating what he was actually supplying to them, went off it and just was expelling a lot more energy, and all of a sudden he had a few cows he started to run into some issues with. So really is one to be mindful of, I'm expecting a few little more issues like that where we see animals really start to chase that green pick can really become a problem.
But it's so enticing. It must be very enticing for a farmer, you know, when they see a bit of greenery come up to say, look, here's a chance, you know, for livestock to have a feed.
Yeah, look, it is, and it's so much better for your mental state to see that bit of green. And I know myself, not playing around in dust is a wonderful thing, but really for your animals, it's important that we really do control them at this stage until that feed gets enough height and there's enough nutrition to meet those animals' needs. We've got them through this far. Let's keep them going and look after them and just a little bit longer, probably a good thing. But look, those people who are lucky enough to get crops in early and on some of the storms and get a bit more feed, yeah, look, excellent for them, and it is something that they do need to be mindful of, trying to manage that, particularly some of these pastures that have had a fair bit of nutrition behind it.
And I guess the advice would be, if in doubt, check, just to make sure that what you're doing is okay.
Yeah, look, just ask, talk, have a yarn to a couple of vets, see what issues are floating around. We've got a pretty good team here in the Central Tablelands with our vets. And look, you know, let your past experiences be a bit of a guide also. Some of these people have been here before. You know, think about other breaks where we've had similar breaks where this green pick's come up. Think about how you've managed it in the past or things that have worked and haven't worked for you, and let that be part of your guide.
Central Tablelands LLS Livestock Officer Brett Littler speaking to Tim Fuchs. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 9 minutes to 1. Coming up shortly, we'll have market information. But before we do that, some dairy news. And a leading dairy figure says the industry needs to stop fixating on milk price and begin addressing other underlying issues, he says, that are affecting the profitability of the dairying sector. Former head of VDL Farms in Tasmania has 30 years of experience managing some of the biggest dairy operations, and he says Australian dairy is losing its edge. There's been no growth over the last 15 years, and it's not because of low prices.
We have to look deeper and realise that our profitability has eroded, but with no change in milk price compared to our peers. And what we will spot in the trends is that our cost of production has gone up more steeply, and that underpinning that is absolutely not has any relationship with pasture harvest, where, for instance, the performance has been quite strong compared to our peers. And it's not to do with other development changes like how good are dairy farmers and how fast they're learning better business management. The core difference is that there has been a gradual farm system change, which is producing more milk per cow from less pasture in the diet and higher levels of concentrate. And that impacts on almost every area of the cost structure negatively, and is demonstrably explains the trend of decreasing profitability and sustainability.
And that internationally recognised ruminant feed specialist has hit back at those claims made by Mr. Beaker, calling them naive and quite misleading. Professor Ian Lane is just back in the country from collecting a nutrition research award from the American Feed Industry Association. The prestigious award recognises his international work in improving animal health standards and profitability in livestock production. And he told Kim Honan it's important that dairy farmers understand there are different approaches to achieving profitability.
It's very important for farmers to focus on the things they can control. So I think in that sense I agree with David's direction, which is that you've got to control what you can control and work hard to improve your internal efficiencies and profitabilities. There are substantial problems with milk pricing. It doesn't reflect the international export price at the moment, the opening prices in Victoria, and that's unreasonable. It raises questions about the efficiency of the processes. But the thing I think I particularly was concerned about was what I'd consider a reasonably naive assessment of changes in management practice in Australia, and that is that David associated increases in grain use with decreased efficiency, and that sort of economic analysis is really flawed. Most economists know that when you put two series of data through time, you have to be extraordinarily careful about associations. You know, we might as well say that big problem is the height of humans affecting the efficiency of the dairy industry, because humans have been growing in height over the last 20 years and there's been a decline in the dairy industry. It's a similar flaw in association. To nail it down, there's been very good work by Dairy Australia in a project called Tasmilk 80, where they demonstrated that there was similar range of efficiencies in production right across the different feeding systems, whether people were more intensive feeders, less intensive feeders, or moderately intensive feeders. And really that work showed quite clearly that there's no linkage necessarily between use of grain and profitability.
So you don't think with cows eating less pasture that's caused a drop in production and profitability?
No, not at all. In fact, most people, as they increase stocking rate, have to allocate less pasture to the cow.
That's Dr. Ian Lane talking there about dairy profitability. On the Country Hour, it's time for markets. First up to casino cattle, and here's Doug Robson.
Good afternoon. Last week's dearer prices drew increased numbers of cattle forward for a total of 1,878. That's up by 560. Close to 1,400 young cattle have been sold, consisting of larger numbers of vealers and weaner cattle, along with increased numbers of light yearlings. Quality was mixed with several runs of well-bred cattle through the sale. However, many were in plainer condition. The market was cheaper, losing last week's gains. Last restocker weaner steers, they were 15 cents cheaper. However, heavier steers were less affected. Most ranged from 195 to 293. Light restocker weaner heifers were up to 30 cents cheaper in places, 166 to 201. The heavy heifers, 207 to 248. Restocker yearling steers sold from 200 to 250, and the heifers 170 to 236. Trade vealers were back by 15 cents, 200 to 257 to average 228. Around 350 ground cattle drawn for and still to be sold. Doug Robson, casino.
And let's go to Carcor Sheep and Lambs now, and here's David Monk.
Good afternoon. Numbers were back by 1,500 for a yarding of 4,700 lambs. It was a fairly plain quality yarding with a large percentage showing the effects of the season and cold conditions. There was a reasonable selection of trade lambs along with only a couple of pens of heavyweights. Lightweight lambs to the processors were around firm, with the 12 to 18 kilogram two scores selling from 60 to 123. Trade lambs were 7 to 9 cheaper, with quality a factor. The 18 to 23 kilogram three scores sold from 120 to 180 to average between 685 and 730 cents a kilogram. The few heavyweight lambs were 7 dearer, with the over 22 kilogram four scores selling from 178 to 223. Restocker lambs were 2 to 5 cheaper, with the better type selling from 58 to 130. Hoggett sold to 180. There were some good lines of crossbred ewes along with plenty of plain sheep in a yarding of 2,600 mutton, where most grades were firm to three cheaper, depending on quality. Two score ewes sold from 55 to 90, while the better three and four scores sold from 94 to $190 for both crossbreds and merinos. This is David Monk at CTLX for MLA.
Let's go to Yash Sheep and Lambs and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon, Michael. Lamb numbers eased by 1,300 for a mixed quality offering of 4,700. There are a few pens of prime and prime trade and heavy lambs, but most were showing the effects of the season. The two-score processing lambs were firm, 74 to 115. Trade lamb to 23 kilos were 60 on the heavy weights. The quality affected the medium weights, and they slipped six, and they sold from 134 to 170. Heavy lambs, 151 to 180, and extra heavies reached 210. Carcass prices, 660 to 690 on average. Merino lambs sold to 143, and hoggets, 180. Mutton quality was mixed and prices eased 3 to 4 on the light and medium weights. Heavy mutton were firm. The medium weights 98 to 150. Heavy crossbred ewes 159 to 210. And Merino Weathers reached 150. And this has been Graham Richard at Yass.
Thanks, Graham. Let's go to Mossvale now and David Kent.
Good afternoon. Similar numbers to last week for a total yarding of 985 fair to plain quality cattle. There was just over 100 cows, some good lines of yearlings and vealers, and the bulk of the offering was made up of young secondary cattle, most showing the effects of the winter conditions. The trade market was strong, especially for cows, and there was a cheaper trend for restocker cattle. Burleys Deceit Butchers were firm, topping at 343 to average 302. Middleweight trade yearling steers were up to 8 dearer, 261 to 359. And yearling heifers to the trade, 6 cheaper to average 288. Feeder steers up 4, 260 to 310. And feeder heifers were 6 cheaper, 255 to 270. Lightweight weaner steers to restockers up to 30 cents cheaper, 235 to 289. And the heifer portion returning to the paddock also 30 cheaper, 140 to 259. Grown steers lifted 10 to top at 285. Lighter and heavier D2 cows were up to 24 cents dearer, 150 to 206. And the heavier 3 and 4 score cows up 20 to top at 240. The best heavyweight bull reached 238 cents per kilogram. This is David Kent at Mossvale for MLA.
And you're listening to The Country Hour. I'm off for a few days. Might watch a bit of tennis, maybe a bit of the World Cup, and David Claughton will be in the chair. On The Country Hour, we're heading up to news time.